The RTS London Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this RTS London session about small acts. I'm Aradhna Tyle and I'm delighted to be chairing. I have a fantastic panel lined up for you today. Small Acts features five stories telling the lived experience of the West Indian diaspora in the UK, spanning over the 1960s to the 1980s. It's a series of five short and feature-length films. Mangrove, the story of the so-called Mangrove Nine, whose trial was the first judicial acknowledgement of behaviour motivated by racism in the Metropolitan Police. Lovers Rock, a romantic drama set in Unofficials blues clubs, where youngsters would go to dance the night away. Red, White and Blue, focusing on the trailblazing black policeman, Leroy Logan. Alex Wheatle, the coming-of-age story of the writer, Alex Wheatle. And Education, highlighting racial segregation in the school system. The series was directed by Steve McQueen. To date, there have been 9 BAFTA nominations, Golden Globes, featured at the Cannes Film Festival. This panel is a great opportunity to hear about the success by this groundbreaking series and find out just how on earth the team did it. So I am absolutely delighted to welcome Tracy Schofield, the executive producer, Courtier Newland, writer on 2 of the episodes, and Gary Davey, casting director. Welcome. All 5 films in the series of Small Acts are still available to watch on BBC iPlayer. If you're watching from outside of the UK, there are other ways of watching. I believe we're also on Amazon Prime. First of all, Tracy Schofield, welcome. It's such an honour to have you here today. I understand you were working with Steve for 10 years, building the ideas and developing the story and taking the story to the BBC. Who ultimately commissioned it. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that process and what made you want to work on this series.
Steve was introduced to me having gone to the BBC and said that he wanted to make a drama series about the West Indian community in London. And that was just that simple idea at that stage. He wanted to make something really for his mother, I think, because he felt that she belonged to a generation of people who'd come to this country from the Caribbean, the West Indies, and there was never anything on television to describe their experience. And that's where he got his idea from. But apart from that, we really didn't know what form it would take. And it was only over a number of years of thinking about it and working on it when he wasn't working on his other films, because of course he went off to make 12 Years and Widows and Shame during the course of that time, that we realised that we were going to have to do the research from scratch, you know, literally go out into the community and meet people and talk to them and get their stories, because they weren't available really in book or written form. And as I discovered, this was a generation who typically didn't write things down and didn't even actually speak to each other between the generations. And that's been one very gratifying thing about these projects going out on television, is that it started the generation speaking to each other, because we had a tremendous amount of feedback on that. And, you know, that's been incredibly rewarding. And with regards to your question, why would I want to get involved? I come at these stories from a different cultural perspective, but I am a Londoner born and bred, and I was born and brought up in West London, where a lot of these stories are set. And for me, anything that is about the history of London or a missing chapter in the history of London is just fascinating. And I often said to Steve how I was just so excited about being taken into a whole new world of culture, a whole new world of lived experience. And that's what made it exciting for me, that learning all about that.
I love that. That idea of dipping into a whole new world really resonates with me. I feel that this is why it's so important to be making these TV dramas and films. And to me, when I was watching them, I felt like I learned a lot about a diaspora that is too often marginalised. And also, they're just really, really good, solid dramas that you could just dig your teeth into. There's 5 very different stories that are covered spanning 20 decades. And as you say, these haven't been told. But how did you go through a process of finding all those stories that you mentioned, talking to people, and then going through the process of choosing which are the 5 stories that you're going to feature?
Well, it was a process of, you know, spreading the net very, very widely to begin with, and just narrowing it down and making selections with Steve. Helen Bart, who was our associate producer, introduced herself to me very, very on as being somebody, a trained broadcast journalist who's very interested in being involved in the research. And I very quickly realized that she was somebody whose skills lay in interviewing, and she was the perfect person to send out into the community, make contact with people and interview them. And we transcribed these interviews. And some of them were from people who, you know, you would consider to be very eminent in that community. And others were from very, very ordinary people who led very, they would consider ordinary lives. But there was something very remarkable and special about reading these transcripts, you know, all together, which was, you know, a highly, highly unique resource that we'd created inadvertently over a period of a year and a half, of a picture, a snapshot of a community and a whole spectrum across that community at a particular time. When it came to choosing the stories, there were clearly some that absolutely stood out in terms of being in the public domain. And I would say that the mangrove was the preeminent story in that arena, because it was an important piece of social and cultural history that, as Steve said, had been swept under the carpet. And most people who follow Steve's career will have heard him use this phrase several times. He used it about hunger. He used it about 12 Years a Slave. These stories which are hiding in plain sight. And the mangrove is an extraordinary story of civil rights in the UK. You know, if this was an American story, there would be many, many books and films about it, I'm sure. Partly because they self-defended and they were acquitted, which is a remarkable outcome. But for us, not only was the mangrove a unique story in itself, but it also laid out the stall for the whole series, telling people, this is what this whole series is going to be about. These are the things we're interested in. It's about collective action. It's about communities of people coming together. And that's where the title Small Acts came in.
I understand that Leroy Logan, whose story is told in Red, White and Black, and Alex in the eponymous title, were actually consultants on those two films. How did those relationships come about?
Well, Helen Bart knew Leroy from her former work, and I'd met Alex along with Courtier, actually, when I was putting the writer's room together. So slightly different entry points for them into the project. But Leroy came in to meet Steve and tell him his story, which was, it is unique, his story, actually. And I think, as so much of us, so much of Small Acts concerns the police and police activity during what was a very kind of disruptive period in social relations between the police and the public, to tell the story of a black officer, i.e. from the other side of the mirror, was, you know, hugely interesting, as well as the actual individual details of Leroy's story and Leroy's relationship with his father. So that was a kind of standout story, really, for us. And Alex's story came to us via Alex in the writer's room. And Courtier will remember this, because Steve had said in the writer's room, I'd like a story about a young kid, a boy, a teenager. And Alistair Siddons, Courtier's co-writer, said to Alex Wheatle, go on, Al, tell Steve your story. And Alex just sat down and told us about his childhood in care, his being taken to a hostel in Brixton as a teenager and, you know, going on the wrong side of the law there and ending up in prison after the Brixton uprising, and meeting his mentor there, who taught him about black culture and black history, and made Alex decide to become a writer. And it's such an aspirational story. And Alex has also such a great sense of humour, and he's such a modest person. His telling of the story was completely spellbinding. And Steve just said at the end, that's it. I want to make a film about you. And of course, Alex had to go off and think about this. I think it was a bit of a shock, but it belonged automatically within the group of stories we were talking about. It had its place as soon as he'd finished speaking, I think.
Tracy, I love that. It makes it feel like this story is really owned by not just Steve, not just the writers, but the whole community. I think it's a fantastic achievement. There's so much more I'd like to come back to on the production element. But Courtney, I think this is a fantastic time to bring you in on the writing side. So you were writing with Steve on Lover's Rock and Red, White and Blue, two very, very different films of very different feels and very different storylines. So Lovers Rock, I believe, is a fictional story based on these kind of unofficial blues parties. And Red, White and Blue, on the other end of the spectrum, very much follows Leroy Logan's story. So let's start generally from your point of view. How was that experience getting involved with those and two such different...
I mean, well, it was a fantastic experience, you know. It's the thing I've been waiting for my whole life, to be able to tell the story of Black Britain on such a massive scale and a massive canvas, and to be working with someone as brilliant as Steve, and to be working with the whole team, and everyone was at the top of their game. So I was really just, you know, bowled over at the opportunity. And actually, you know, for a couple of years when I knew the project was happening, you know, it'd been talked about in the community, it'd been talked about in the broadcast papers, you know, in the media. And, you know, I'd wanted to do this project. I was saying I would really be perfect for this project. But, you know, I had to wait a while to see whether that was going to happen or not. But I was really, like, from the minute I heard about it, I was like, that's what I want to be involved in. That's what I want to do.
And to what extent were you in the process of deciding which stories you want to tell? I mean, from the way that Tracy describes it, I love this idea that there's obviously a very, very clear vision in Steve's mind, as well as in each of those people who contributed. But then to have that flexibility to hear another story and say, yes, that's the one. Yeah. How was that process for you? And to what extent did you come knowing the story that you wanted to tell?
Yeah, it didn't quite work like that. I didn't know particularly which story I wanted to tell. And at the time when I was talking to Steve about being involved in the project, I only knew about Mangrove. And then, or I knew a little bit about Lovers Rock. I knew Lovers Rock was kind of on the table because I'd heard Steve talk about it in interview a couple of times. But then when we sat down, we heard the full extent of the range of stories that were going to be told. And yeah, I think by then Steve knew pretty much. He was like, we're going to have this story, this story, this story, this story. And we were like, great. I mean, like, they all sound fantastic. And so it was more a process of trying to work out how we would tell those stories, kind of like breaking the story in the room. And we spent 6 weeks, was it, I think, Tracy? I can't remember. 6 weeks working on that and trying to work out exactly how each episode would be structured, who the characters are, getting to know each other as writers, you know, that kind of thing. And then every so often, you know, Steve would say to someone, okay, so I want you to do this story, or I want you to do that story. And I remember waiting for a couple of weeks, if I remember rightly. And I was like, I haven't been given a story. What does that mean? What's happening here? I can see people are getting their stories and getting a little bit nervous. And then one day Steve came up to me and put his arm around me and said, you know, I want you to do Leroy Logan. And I was like, ah, great. Because that story, I felt, was a very difficult one. And it was quite intimidating just because of, you know, the enormity of what Leroy had done. And the fact that it was opposition, but from a completely different perspective. You know, it was trying to change things from the inside, you know. And I was slightly intimidated about how I would tell that story, even while at the same time knowing that it was just a brilliant story. Just amazing.
I totally understand that. It's really fascinating and humbling to hear you speak like that. You, the author of 7 books, you co-edited the Penguin Book of New Black Writing in Britain. This is obviously something that you're deeply passionate about and have touched on so much through your career. And of course, as we've just heard, you were working with the subject of your story, and it is a huge story. There's a whole life there. Tell me a little bit about that process.
Well, that was the other thing that was intimidating, because I'd never written about someone who actually existed. And, you know, at some point in time, at that point, had been sitting across the table from me telling his story. So I was really intimidated about writing somebody who was real. But Leroy was just amazing through the process, you know. I hooked up with him straight away. And he said, I think at the first screening we went to, when everything was all said and done, Leroy stood up and said, I spoke to this man more than my wife at certain points in time, you know. So like every week or so, you know, for many, many, many months, I would ring Leroy up and we'd have a conversation for an hour or so, and I'd say, tell me about this, tell me the details of how that happened. I met Lee John, I met Gretel, I talked to them about Leroy. And, you know, I could send him emails, he would send us photographs, he'd be on the phone at like readily. And you know what? During that process as well, what I found really interesting is that I would go out into the community and do like readings from my books and stuff like that. I'd go to film nights that were organized by certain people in the community. And Leroy would be there like routinely. You know, I'd like be looking in the back and I'd see Leroy sitting there, or I'd be going to on a train somewhere and Leroy would be going to talk about like gun or knife crime at, you know, at City Hall or something like that. So I saw how actively he was working in the community even while I was writing it, and our paths just kept crossing. So I got to know Leroy really, really well, and he was just completely generous throughout the whole process. Didn't ask to see the script, didn't ask what I was doing, didn't ask about the story, completely hands-off as well. He just trusted us, which was amazing.
That's fantastic. That trust that people give to us as filmmakers, as writers, as producers, is so valuable and so precious. And Tracy, I'd like to bring you back in at this point as well. We are talking about big characters with complex histories. What was your thinking in terms of how you handle those stories? Of course, you know, Steve had a very specific vision. And to contextualize this, I'd like to say, from my point of view, watching the stories, I was absolutely gripped. I learned a huge amount. And I always left feeling a little bit better about the world. I felt uplifted. I felt they were redemptive. And I feel that that is a real skill as storytellers. And I'd love to hear your thoughts and your journey working with Steve on crafting these stories.
Well, that was actually, of course, you will testify, you know, I think there was a 2-year gap between the writer's room and us all really sitting down in earnest to start pre-production, because Steve had gone off to make another film. And I thought, okay, this is my chance to get the script really going and get them in really good shape so that by the time Steve can look at them again, he'll be amazed at how much progress we've made and delighted by what he sees. And, you know, Kortia and Al worked tirelessly, and Alex was very helpful. Alex Wheatle was very helpful, you know, in terms of his advice as a consultant from the writer's room to get the scripts. We went through several drafts, Kortia can testify this, before Steve actually read them, because he was busy. And I just know, Steve always says you only get to look at a script the first time once, or a film the first time once. And I've always known that. And that first impression is hugely important. I didn't want to send him anything that would just not be the best it could be for that particular moment. And, you know, there's no doubt that in my mind that having that length of time to really think about these things, you know, most television dramas have to be made much more rapidly than I think most writers would like, and episodes written much more quickly. And I think that the time we had, and then the time Steve was able to give these scripts once he joined the process. And when he did join the process, you certainly knew about it. He was not, you know, he's very engaged and involved and really gets his sleeves rolled up. It was a real opportunity for us to not only think about what these stories were really about. You know, they weren't just the stories. They were really about very big themes, and also incorporate a lot of detail, which takes quite a long time to research, you know, and particularly when you're telling stories about real people's lives and real people who are alive. And that's the mangrove, because there are still two of the mangrove nine, Althea Gensler-Quad and Barbara Bees, are still with us. And they were kind of involved to a degree with and Alex, and obviously Leroy. You have a real duty of care to make sure that you're very authentic. And that's not just to them, it's to anybody in their family or group. So there's a much more work that goes into, I think, from my experience, making a film about a real set of circumstances and real people, and a responsibility as well, than writing something that's completely fictional. And I think, Kortia, you can speak about that, because Lovers Rock was completely liberating in comparison, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a kind of a bit of a breath of fresh air, to be honest with you, because I'd had to, like, it's really strange, because I've had to adhere to a very strict set of rules when I was writing Red, White and Blue with Steve. And I think that the thing is that it was really liberating in one sense, because I knew very clearly what I could do, but also it was like, you know, I had to be so careful, and it was, as I was saying earlier, slightly intimidating. And I think the difference between that and Lovers Rock is that, you know, I could just really let go, in a sense, and do things in a way that I felt was slightly more challenging to myself as a writer. And what was really lovely about it was that, you know, it's like what Tracy said, when Steve's involved, he's really involved, but he's also very, very clear about what he wants and what he doesn't want, you know, and he's great with ideas as well. I mean, he's just so quick. And so it was a really nice back and forth. And I was saying this yesterday, I was talking to Steve yesterday about the synergy between us. And just there was lots of things we talked about, but there were also certain things that we understood because we got on the same vibe. And working on the scripts with him was just like amazing, because it was just, you know, like I said, back and forth the whole time. He was remembering things about West London. I was remembering things about that. And with Lovers Rock, it was just like, okay, this play, let's have some fun, you know, let's enjoy ourselves. And I think you can really feel that in the film.
I absolutely do feel that sense of fun. You feel like you're in the party. You feel what it's like. And I think that's really interesting how it sits within the series of the five films as quite a different experience. It's almost documentary-like in its feel and the way you sort of skim through the story. It's really interesting to hear how you worked with Steve on that. Gary, I'm going to come over to you in just a second, so I'd love to know more about how you cast for something like that. First, I'd just like to remind you, if you're watching this at home, you can send in your questions in the chat on YouTube, and I'll try to get to them in just a moment. So Gary, we've been talking about working with Leroy Logan and people who are still alive, people who are sharing their stories. How on earth do you go about casting that?
Well, there is a duty of care, as Tracy has said, but the authenticity is important. And as casting directors, we always want to get someone who looks like the real person. So that's always in the back of our minds. And I've still got the picture of the Mangrove Nine here beside me at my desk, actually. And if you do look at those picture of the Mangrove Nine, there is definitely similarities to the casting that we actually did. But Steve always just said he wants the right person for the part. So even if there was names flying around, that was always very exciting for him. But genuinely, he just wants and loves good actors. And we are never going to run out of good actors in this country. So it was just an exciting, respectful, collaborative process, which I absolutely loved.
Actually, we have a still of Malachi Kirby, who plays Darkest Hal in Mangrove. And I think that if we could have a look at that, it will attest to just how similar they are in look. It's striking.
Yeah, great.
So your cast across the five films, really diverse, and you feature many stalwarts of the Black British West Indian acting community back in the days of the A-Force in the 90s, Luella Gideon, Robbie G, Joe Martin. What was your experience in going out and finding those, the new talent, the stalwarts, people that speak to a whole community in a diaspora, whilst wanting to really stay true to, as you say, who is the best actor for this part?
Well, I do think that casting directors, we're always on the lookout. That's our jobs. You know, we are constantly working. We're always looking for good actors. So Steve first told me about this project, not exactly what it was, but something was brewing about a London, and I'm a West Londoner. So I think we all are, actually, all the three of you talking to today and Steve are all West Londoners. But something's just jumped up on my computer. Sorry. What was the question again? Sorry.
No problem at all. You were just talking about how casting directors are looking at the talent available and who speaks to the right parts.
Yes. So I was always kind of on the lookout for, you know, 8 years. I think I got introduced, Steve introduced me to Tracy in 2016. We could have cast this show twice over easily, I think, with the amount of talent that we've got here. But it was really just being respectful and just getting the right person for the part.
Yeah. And you say you could have cast it two or three times over. I believe you did cast it two or three times over. So 8 years is a long time to be casting for something that features a lot of young people. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So there was, yeah. So we had an idea for the youthful episode, and by the time we were ready to actually shoot, it was 4 years later and those people weren't as youthful as they were. But, you know, I go to all the drama schools and to National Youth Theatre and stuff. And there was, interestingly, a girl, I'm a mentor at the National Youth Theatre, and there was a girl that I was very fond of who I was helping mentoring. And when I read Lovers Rock, she literally jumped into my head. That was the face that I imagined playing this role, Amara J. Introduce her to Steve. at a table read, which we did for that episode. It was an amazing episode. And she got the role. In fact, how we cast Lovers Rock was a lot of prep for the right young people for those roles. Because Steve was in the middle of shooting Mangrove and he didn't have time to do loads and loads of meetings. And already I was squeezing in his lunch breaks and on his days off in his office to try and do casting for the other episodes. But for this one, for Lovers Rock, we actually did a table read with everybody. Hazel, our dialect coach, was involved as well. We made sure everybody gave it a couple of weeks' work. And we sat round the table and we read Lovers Rock. And one of the actors just started drumming on the table and it just was instantly electric. It was so magical. Everyone was so into character and everyone was young and full of life. They gave it the best that they could, which was fantastic. And Steve just kicked back at the end and he just went, "I want you all." And pretty much, I think there was about 90% of that table was how we cast Lovers Rock.
Such a fantastic story. And of course, you are a longtime collaborator with Steve. You also casted Hunger as well. And something that I want to come to is the fact that I mentioned that Small Axe is 5 independent films that make up a series. So to be really clear, this isn't casting for a series and when you're done, you're done. As you said, Steve was already shooting while you were casting for future episodes. Each one, I believe Mangrove is 2 hours, 7 minutes. The others range between 60 to 70 minutes. Those are 5 feature length films shot in a very short amount of time. And I want to come to Tracy in a minute to find out a bit more about that. But how was that experience for you, casting essentially 5 films within the space and time and budget of a miniseries?
Yeah, I didn't quite realise how big it was at first. And I was actually starting to prep on 2 other shows at the same time, which, of course, was madness because I had to let those 2 other shows go. So I literally gave absolutely 100% to this, which I had to do, of course, and wanted to do. So I had to let other things go. But it was a fantastic, fantastic collaborative experience.
Tracy, I'd like to come to you to that very point. I'm absolutely blown away. I didn't mean it lightly when I said this is a groundbreaking series, both in terms of content and storyline and context, but also from a production point of view. As I say, this is 5 feature films that you're shooting. Tell me about that. How on earth did you get such a fantastic, dedicated crew? And how did you manage that within essentially a miniseries timeline?
Well, that goes right back to the beginning of my first sort of meetings with Steve, really, because I never really asked him what made him choose to work with me. But I think that part of what interested him was that I was somebody who had experience in both television production and feature film production, having worked at BBC Films for 10 years. And the fact is, the production on set elements are the same, but the way that producers go about shaping these things is quite different, and the approach is quite different. I mean, a lot of television has to be made, as I mentioned earlier, very, very rapidly on very, very tight schedules. And, you know, there are shortcuts you can make that are legitimate, and then all producers will be familiar with having to make compromises. And as I realized immediately with Steve is a filmmaker who has all of those sort of passions about attention to detail and not really making any compromises unless he has to. And then there would be very creative compromises and solutions he would come up with. And I realized that I had to put him together with a group of people who were also filmmakers in the forms of Mike Elliott and Anita Overland, who were our 2 producers. And Anita and Mike sort of piggybacked each other through the schedule. One of them would take the weight of one of the films, and then the next one they'd be preparing ahead and they'd take the kind of weight of the next film. So yes, we did have effectively something like a mini-series schedule, though a few more days. We had to do a few more days filming during the first lockdown, actually, because we wanted to enhance Red, White and Blue. So Courtier knows it went up from being 65 to 84 minutes, and we had a bit of reshooting to do. So it was a generous mini-series schedule, but it was nevertheless a series schedule. And the way we broke it up was to film each film in a block, 6-day weeks, and then have a 4-day hiatus between the films. And that seemed like an incredible luxury at the time, but actually that was all the team were given, was to turn the films around. It was 4 or 5 days in between each film. Each film, you know, was, you know, had its own schedule that were different lengths. And actually Lovers Rock was the one that we had to do cheaply. It was the one which we had to shoot digitally, because some of the others were shot on proper film stock, 35mm for Mangrove, for example, 16mm for Education, all part of Steve's vision about how he wanted to deliver these films and what he wanted to look like. But again, just additional elements that made every single one of them so different from each other that it was like starting from scratch each time. And I just actually quickly want to do say, you know, I think this has been recognised by the BAFTA juries this year, because obviously we've been nominated for 15 BAFTAs. That's one for almost every single head of department, which is a real testimony to the craft of this series. And I think that's what the juries are acknowledging with those nominations.
Absolutely. And very, very well deserved. I think that as a producer myself, I find it really fascinating where the lines between television drama and film do blur. As you say, from a craft point of view, you just want to make the best, most beautiful and most relevant and authentic piece that you can. From a producer's point of view, there are very, very different challenges, and I feel you're being a little bit modest in describing those challenges. Absolutely. I'd like to talk a little bit, just to touch briefly on some production elements. And the five films span 2 decades, over the 60s, 70s and 80s, so it's 3 decades. And so there's very, very, what I felt, authentic feels in terms of the production design, in terms of the costumes. And unfortunately, Helen Scott, the production designer, wasn't able to join us today. But I think it's really fantastic, and I believe that that's testament to the production as a whole and the writing process, the casting process, to get those things right. Something that I wanted to raise was having diverse, not just storylines and casts in productions, but also having diverse crews working on films in order to be able to draw out those authentic feels. And I'd like to touch on that on every aspect. And Courtier, will come to you in a minute to find out about how you write for a very diverse cast. Tracy, when you were crewing up, was this something very much on your mind?
Oh, absolutely, right from the start. I had nightmares a couple of years before we made it about the idea of an entirely white crew standing behind the camera facing a black cast. And I thought, that is not going to happen. But, you know, it was a very, very busy time in the industry when we shot this. And, you know, there were a number of key people Mike and Anita had identified that they wanted to go to, you know, with West Indian backgrounds, to be heads of department. But they were all really busy. They just could not do it. So we had to rethink it. And I thought, okay, we're going to get the volume up. The point was getting the volume up within the individual team. So we were fortunate enough to have two heads of department, Lisa, who's costume designer on Mangrove, and Shabier Kirchner, our DOP, you know, had proper West Indian backgrounds. But we just put a lot of pressure on all of the heads of department to really stretch beyond their utmost to recruit new people within their team, so they might not have worked before. And we also persuaded Amazon, who have the series in the US, and the BBC here, to contribute together towards a trainee scheme, which meant that we brought in a trainee for every single department. And it did mean that when we kind of did a kind of spot check when we went into production in London, that 33% of the crew were actually West Indian, pretty specifically West Indian. I think there, you know, there were a few other groups represented, but I felt it was important that they're West Indian because of the culture of the series and that they would be able to bring more to it because of their own backgrounds. And that was just great, because they really did bring more to it. Surprise, surprise, you know. And it just made for a very, very happy feel, the production office and on the set.
I'm really delighted to hear about the trainee scheme. I feel that this is just such an important thing. And I hope that everyone out there is listening to that champions for more of the same. Thank you. And Courtier, from the writing perspective, I feel that as well as, you know, this idea of having diverse storylines, as well as diverse crews and diverse casts, I'm really interested in this diversity within diversity. This isn't just, is it black or white, or is it white or not white? And I'm really interested to hear from your point of view how you navigate those layers. So to contextualise through many of the stories, including Red, White and Blue, we see Leroy Logan has a colleague who is from the South Asian diaspora. We see that theme running throughout as well, in terms of it's not just who is from the West Indies. It was a whole period of change where lots of people from different ethnic minority backgrounds in different countries were coming to the UK. And I found it interesting how the stories touch on different lived experience, whilst also thinking about the West Indian diaspora. That doesn't just mean one person. Every person in there are a whole range of different countries, there's different accents, there's different wealth levels and educations and backgrounds. My personal feeling was that this was handled really delicately, sensitively, and not shied away from. Was that a very conscious decision? And could you talk me through that process?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of Red, White and Blue, I was really conscious that it represented the 80s that I grew up in. And I mean, I went to school, as everyone's been saying, I'm West London born and bred. And when I went to school, there was like 127 different languages spoken in my primary school. So I felt with particularly Red, White and Blue, it was really important to show a range of different people and represent London as it actually was and is now. And that's always what I'm striving for in any of the stories I'm telling about London, is to represent it authentically. And there's no way I could have written that story without including, you know, the struggle as it was back then, you know, for black people. And black was a political term as well in the 80s. I know a lot of young people now are quite shocked to hear how liberally the term black was used in those days. But it was a reality. And so I wanted to reflect that, because I remember that. I remember it really well. And vividly. And with Lovers Rock, it was quite interesting, because I leant very heavily on my Jamaican heritage. I'm Jamaican Barbadian, or Jamaican Bajan, as we call it. And like, I think I leant quite heavily on that in the script. But then Hazel, our dialect coach, again, she came in and she said, you know what, I'm going to mix this up a little bit, and I'm going to put some Trini in it here. I'm going to put some St. Lucian here. And I thought that was really great too. So, and even with, I think in Red, White and Blue, yeah, we had a little bit of St. Lucian in there as well. So that's just reflective of the Black British community as it is. And of course it goes much, much wider and farther than that, actually.
Yeah. And alongside that, of course, we're talking about first, second, third generation people as well.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I've really, in my career so far, I've always really concentrated on third generation and beyond. You know, so again, with Small Axe, it was a really novel chance for me to be able to go back and talk about second generation, first generation, you know, and tell those stories. But to be able to mix it up, especially in Lovers Rock, you know, where there were some people who lean more heavily on their UK accent, some people who lean quite heavily into the Jamaican patois and all the other patois of the diaspora, I thought it was really, really, it was a great opportunity, you know, and I'd love to do more with that in the future.
Yeah. And Gary, to that same point about, you know, looking at people coming from very, very different backgrounds, obviously a lot of that is in the direction, but from a casting point of view, what's your approach when you're looking at telling these very personal lived experiences and therefore who you cast?
Well, it's all in the script, and you go from the script, and also your own research. You know, I was growing up in the 80s as well, so I was around in a lot of this time. So it really is, you do ask people where they're from. And it's interesting, you know, heritage is a fascinating thing. So, you know, on this one, we don't usually do it, but it was important that we did find out where people were from and asked about their backgrounds. So that was incorporated in this. Yeah.
And is that at the stage where you're inviting people to audition?
Yes, you know, we had our lists, we had our fabulous lists, and it's just, it was just one of the things that we did before we got them into audition, yeah. And Steve was keen on that too. But the representation is, you know, hugely important in these stories, and representing lots of different ethnicities and backgrounds too, as Courteous said, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that, and Tracy, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this idea of representing those lived experiences and having, there's a lot more scrutiny, I would say, of seeing representation, not just in the storyline, but who it is that's playing those characters and who it is behind the camera as well. And of course, we've already talked about your approach to that within Small Acts. I'm interested to know a bit more about your thoughts and feelings on that whilst getting the best person for the job, frankly.
You mean in general?
Yes, please.
Well, I think, you know, every single, as Gary will say, you know, every single, you cast every single role in an individual way. And I would say that it's very difficult to create a general ruling about that across drama, because every project is so different and every role is so different. But my first instinct would be to go for the person who's best for the job. I think Gary would probably agree with that. I know Steve would. And then you kind of work out around that, if that is the right fit, you know, in terms of background and so forth. But yeah, the best person for the job. And that might mean that actually, by being representative of that person, that individual, in whichever kind of way you're talking about, they are the best person for the job. That's a bit vague. I can only be vague about something without a specific example to discuss, really, I think.
I think, Tracy, that says it all, to be honest. I absolutely agree that it needs to be very project specific. And I would just hope, I suppose this is a general plea out to the community, to always keep it in mind when we are looking at specific projects. And I'm really pleased to hear, as I said, about the trainee scheme. I know that you were very specific when you were looking at your HODs as well. Jojo, the makeup director, of course, she has a lot of experience in doing hair and makeup for Black people. She does Idris Elba quite a lot. Unfortunately, she's on production in South Africa today. She would have been joining us. And I think that it's really interesting. We spoke about this earlier, Tracy, when we look at how you approach production, when you look at different lighting that might be needed, different types of production design within homes. And you said it was really interesting how for many people within your crew, it wasn't a question, it wasn't an issue, whereas we know there are stories reasonably recently, unfortunately, where DPs have told us you can't like Black people.
Yes, I mean, I've heard that, not recently, but in my distant past at BBC Films, that used to be something that I heard with shocking regularity, actually, to the point where I think people just accepted it without questioning it. You get some old DP saying you can't like Black skin in the same room as a white skin, and people just accept it as though that was a technical fact. I can honestly say that was never even a conversation on Small Acts. Never even a conversation. It just happened.
I find it really fascinating how the lighting in particular does change from scene to scene. It really is used, and Shabir does a fantastic job of using the lighting, the camera work to really take you into different places when you're within the mangrove, for example, within the restaurant, within a community, in a meeting of the Black Panthers, or that scene where you're in a police station. It's an all-white cast at that point, of course, in the police station. And it really hit me as something different within the context of the Hubble film.
Yes, I mean, I think you're saying that it was well lit, and it was. I mean, Steve, we're very closely with Shabier, establishing the look not only of the individual films, which have their own particular kind of palette and their own tone, their own lighting scheme, to try and achieve the kind of texture he wants to achieve. A friend of mine said to me the other day something I thought was really, really smart about Steve, which I haven't thought of before, when I said that he chose his film stock, each film, to fit the story he was telling. So as I said, Mangrove was 35 millimeter because he wanted it to be this cinematic experience. An education right at the other end of the scale, a tiny little domestic film was shot on 16 mil, which typically films were shot on up until the mid 80s, but haven't been recently because you can't deliver that in an HD format to a broadcaster. But what 16 mil does look like is films that were made in the early 70s. It's just got that texture about it. And this friend of mine said, well, he's a painter. He's choosing the medium to make his painting. And so he uses the film stock, which is the medium, it's the oil or the whatever it is, the oil paint. And then the lighting is the tone and his colour. That's how he lights. And I think that he was very fortunate in finding in Chabier somebody just completely understood what he was looking for and what he wanted to achieve and did it more or less intuitively.
We've got an audience question here about, you mentioned there were various different film formats used and in particular 16 millimeter. The audience would like to know what the BBC had to say about going back to using 16.
Well, as you can imagine, working with Steve McQueen, every single day there's a new conversation to be had either with your broadcaster or with somebody about doing something differently, because, and as I say, you know, Steve's a filmmaker. He didn't know what all of the kind of often understood but unspoken rules are about television production and television delivery, which is everything shot on digital. And we had to have a conversation with the BBC, not only, you know, our commissioners, but actually all of the technical departments too. Very long, extensive conversations about what would happen if we delivered in a format that couldn't be on the HD channel. And I have to say, although these conversations were, you know, long and went back and forth a lot, the BBC were hugely supportive about everything Steve was trying to do. They just wanted to make sure that they could deliver it and it would be stable, because the one thing we didn't want to see happening on BBC One live on air was buffering, or, you know, the film kind of suddenly, you know, stopping. That wasn't going to happen, but there are technical concerns that they had to be careful of. I, on the other hand, I don't think they'd want to make a habit of people suddenly all saying, I want to shoot my film on 16 millimeter. I don't think that's a model they'd be willing to follow on an everyday basis.
Yeah, I can't see that happening, but it's fantastic the sorts of innovative ingenuity you get when you have Steve McQueen attached. I'd be really interested to see what happens next, especially on that TV versus film approach. Thank you so much. We're running out of time. I'd like to thank my panel, Tracy Schofield, Courtney Newland and Gary Davey. Thank you so much. I feel like I could talk about each and every one of those five films for another couple of hours. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
If you'd like to catch up on the series, as I said, you can watch them all in the UK on BBC iPlayer, in the US on Amazon Prime. That's all we've got time for today's session. If you'd like to catch up, it will be on YouTube later. Just have a look at RTS London. You can follow us on social media and we'll point you in the right direction. Do stay tuned to the website. We have a whole host of events coming up. And don't forget, we also have the RTS London podcast. You can catch up with the events. Just search for it on your favourite podcast provider. It's RTS London podcast. Thanks again to my panel. Thanks to everyone for joining in, and look forward to seeing you next time.
The RTS London podcast.